Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of All Together Now. What the hell? Thanks. So, we've got a great episode for you this time. Motown, in its day, was so big and had so many stars, and the guy that made some of those stars what they were is the man you're about to meet.
I'm Mickey Stevenson, Motown's first A&R man, and I had the pleasure of pegging and introducing some of the greatest talent in the world to Motown and to the rest of the country.
It's so true. I mean, when we talk about people like Marvin Gaye and Stevie Wonder,
Four Tops, yeah. Vandellas, the Funk Brothers, One at a Time I brought them in, Kim Weston, and of course, Martha Reeves.
And the Vandellas. And when you talk about bringing them in, you found them.
I discovered them. I go out around the country and I found them. Some came in for auditions, but most of them I found out around the country in different places and all that.
Who was your biggest star of the biggest stars?
Well, I got to say Martha was one of the biggest stars because she became my secretary in the beginning, and she went from a secretary to producing and singing, and not producing, but singing one of the biggest songs in the world, Dancing in the Street.
You can sing a little bit of that, right?
Calling out around the world, are you ready for a brand new beat? Music here, time is right for dancing in the street. We're dancing in Chicago.
I like it, you know.
Down in New Orleans.
Yo.
Don't forget the Motor City. All we need is music. Sweet, sweet music. Music everywhere. I love that song.
I love that song, too. And Martha Vandella. And Vandellas were wonderful. But Martha Reeves is somebody I know.
Yeah.
She later became a city council member in Detroit.
Yes.
And so she's really had quite the career herself of all kinds of things in her life.
Yes.
You brought Stevie Wonder onto the
stage.
And
yes,
tell me about that story.
Well, Stevie.
But first sing me For Once in My Life. Come on.
For once in my life. I have someone who needs me, someone I needed so long. That was a song was by written by.
God, I can't remember. It was written by that kid that your assistant brought in.
No. That song was written by Ron Milner.
He was
a pizza salesman.
That's it.
I got to tell you this story.
Go ahead.
We're in Chicago. Barry wanted the jazz label.
Barry Gordy.
He wanted the jazz label. He said, okay, Waymar, you get me a jazz label. And I said, Barry, come on, man. Jazz? He said, I want a jazz label. We got to diversify. I said, okay. I go in to New York first because that's where all the jazz guys were. And I got some pretty good musicians together. We're cutting product. And we're in the studio. And so I'm telling the guys, we're going to make a great album. And we come up with our follow-up album and all that. And I'm finding that they don't want to sign contracts. They don't mind making an album with this artist and one with this person. And so they were like doing it like single albums. So I called Barry. I said, man, it's not going to work because we can't keep them with us on a certain amount of time as an artist. And he said, well, what are you going to do? I said, I'm going to find me like a Nancy Wilson kind of person.
Oh, there's a name.
And then I'll put some orchestras and songs behind her, and she'll be signed to us on our label, and we'll build our jazz line. He said, great idea. Okay, I said, well, I got to go to Chicago because that's where those kind of singers are. I go to Chicago. All right. And I found the girl. She was great. I said, okay, I need some songs now to fit the artist. So I told her, I said, I want you to bring me, you've been working all the clubs around here, bring me all the guitar players and piano players that you know, that you work with. She said, why? I said, because I want to hear their songs. She said, but they're guitar players and piano players. I said, no. All guitar players write songs. That's how they keep feeling their notes in there. I said, and all piano players got songs. And they just don't, they come as a piano player, but they got them in their heads. I want to hear what's in their heads, because one or two of them could be exactly the song I'm looking for. So she brought them. They came, I'm at her house, we have an auditions, had a little rhythm section there anyway, and they come in, but they would want to impress me that they're jazz musicians. I said, no. you know, can you give me your song? Well, and the song would have the same feeling as a jazz song. I found myself wasting a lot of time. I said, okay. I decided I would take her back to Detroit and have my guys write songs for her. So, but in the meantime, the guys just come out 1 o'clock in the morning, and the musicians say, man, can we get some pizza or something? We're hungry. I said, okay, order some pizza. They ordered the pizza. The pizza guy come. Now, we're on the south side of Chicago.
Now, here's where the story gets good.
Gets good. South side of Chicago, 1 o'clock in the morning. The white boy comes in with the hat on, with the white outfit, the pizza in the hand. I said, hey, man, are you crazy? You coming over here at this hour like that? You get shot or robbed or something. I said, man, drop that pizza and get out of here. All I need is Mickey Stevenson, Motown, and, you know, somebody robbed him. I said, uh-uh. He said, but I heard you looking for songs. I said, so? He said, well, I'm a songwriter. I said, I appreciate that. Would you drop that pizza and get out of here? He said, no, but you ought to hear my song. I said, listen, man, would you get out of here? I don't need no problem. He said, can I? And he kept talking. I said, hold it. I told the piano player, I said, get up. I said, can you play your song? He said, yeah. I said, play it right now. I really want to get rid of him, right?
Right. You're trying to push him out the door.
He sat down, made an arpeggio. Then he started singing, for once in my life, I have someone who... He starts crying, once unafraid. I said, stop. You wrote that song? He said, yeah. I said, okay, you got any more? He said, yeah. He started to play. I said, don't play it. I reached in my pocket. I said, here's for the pizza. I said, now here's another $100. I said, you meet me at the airport, and I'll take you to Detroit and make you a songwriter. And he said, you would? I said, yeah. So he started to the door, and he turned back. Now, the other musicians sitting there, they say, hey, man, you give that boy that money, and you ain't give us that kind of money. He ain't going to that white boy going to take that money and run. I said, hey, man. And Ron Miller turned around with the money in his hand now. And he said, well, hey, what if I don't show up? I said, I lose $100, you lose a career. He looked at me. He walked out. I'm at the airport about an hour and a half later. He comes walking down the aisle, down the airport, with a little bag in his hand. I said, where are your clothes? Looked like a hospital bag, a doctor's bag. I didn't see no clothes. He said, right here. I said, okay, come on. Take him into this, flew into Detroit. In those days, you know, you could go one way, remember?
Right.
Oh, that's the chase. Anyway, I brought him to Detroit, went right to the office. Went to the finance department. I said, I want you to give him $250 a week, and I want you to give him $500 to get himself a place to stay right away. So the finance, they hated me because I was always doing things past my limit, right?
Yeah.
He said, well, I can't do that. You're paying him like you're paying the other writers. And I said, that ain't none of your business. This is my department. I said, take it out of my department. So Barry gave me a separate budget for studios and all that. I said, you take it out of there. And he said, well, I'm going to have to tell Mr. Gordy about that. I said, you tell anybody you want to. Just give him the money. You know what I mean? So I left. 10 minutes later, Barry comes over to my office with the finance guy. And he said, Waymar, you just signed the guy, paying him like you're paying the other writers, and another $500 to go get some apartment or something. I said, hold it, Barry. Hang on. Ron, come here. Play that song you played for me in Chicago. Ron sat down, made arpeggio, start singing, for once in my life, I have someone who needs me, someone. He goes to the bridge. Son, I'm afraid, I don't know what I got. And tears rolling down his eyes. As long as I know it. Barry said, stop. He called me and said, come here, Mick. He said, man. That's a great song. He said, what are we going to do with it? I said, I don't know right now. I said, but we need his kind of music mixed with our kind of music. See, Ron's was like a Broadway style, right?
Right.
We need to mix that with our sound, and nobody could stop us. We covered the whole nine yards. He said, yeah. He said, but what are we going to do with that song? I said, I don't know yet, Barry, but I'll figure out something.
And you did, and it became one of the biggest songs of all time. And it's a song I love.
Yeah.
I got to tell you a Stevie Wonder story real quick. When I was in Houston, and I went to the University of Houston, I worked at radio stations down there, and I had a little DJ gig to make a little extra money at a disco club called The Godfather. And one night I went in and the manager says, pull up all the Stevie Wonder albums you got because he's coming in tonight and he likes to listen to his music. And I thought, why would he want to listen to his music? Why wouldn't he want to listen to other music? And so, you know, All right. So we did that, and in comes Stevie Wonder, and he sits down with his entourage, and I start playing Stevie Wonder music one song after another, and he's sitting there, and he's kind of dancing in the air, and, you know, I could see he was really enjoying himself listening to his music in a nightclub in the big speakers, and that was my experience with Stevie Wonder.
Oh, yeah.
And it was, you know, I really enjoyed putting something out there that he would enjoy, and I've remembered that to this day, which is pretty cool because sometimes I can't remember what happened yesterday. So that's pretty impressive. One of the stories, and you've got a book here, and I want you to just tell everybody about it. It's the A&R Man, and A&R stands for
Artist and Repertoire,
and it's Motown's first A&R Man presents the A&R Man.
Presents the A&R Man.
And you tell a number of stories in here of things in your career. One of the things you talk about is your relationship with Marvin Gaye. Mm-hmm. And Marvin Gaye was somebody you took in almost like you considered him a brother, but it was almost like a father-son.
Well, yeah, well, we were closer age-wise, so it was like a brother, you know, a brother that brother from another mother, as we say.
Yeah, but I mean in the sense, excuse me, in the sense of mentoring.
Yes.
And being there to pull him out of his jazz, you know, lovings, mm-hmm. if that's a word I just made up, and into something that you thought might make him even more marketable.
Yes, yes, and he listened. Which was really great. I was doing my 9-to-5 job, but then after that, from 6 o'clock on, I was creating. Mm-hmm. And Marvin would be creating with me, and sometimes we'd go till 1 and 2 o'clock in the morning, go to my house, which was about maybe 5 minutes away. We'd go in there, get something to eat, relax for a few minutes, then get on the piano at my place, and then come right back to the studio and do it. We did that around the clock. And at the time, Marvin wasn't the superstar that he turned out to be. He would even, to change clothes, he would wear my pants. And you can imagine it looked like Little Lloyd Fundor because I'm shorter than him, so you can see it's half his leg. But we couldn't change because he was right there with me. And so we were really close, really close. And we worked night and day.
You tell a really interesting story about how you helped to convert him from his sort of jazz leanings, using his gospel and pulling him in a very unusual sort of way. Mm-hmm. Can you sort of go through that?
Well, when Barry absorbed the label, Anna Records, he brought Marvin. Marvin was on that line, him and Harvey Fuqua and a few other people. When he brought him to me, he said, okay, Wilmar, I want to hit on this guy. And I'm telling Barry, come on, man, he's a jazz singer. You know, that's less than 15% of the market or something. You know what? He said, I didn't see a jazz hit. I want a hit record. Now, you said you can do anything? Prove it. I said, okay. He said, $500. I said, $1,000 on this. We bet all the time. He said, okay, $1,000 is the bet. Now, I had to get Marvin to know about him as a person. You know, when you're writing with somebody or you're working with somebody, you want to kind of feel out where their thoughts are and all that to get the best out of them that you can get. And so I knew this was going to be a job because he was already locked into doing jazz. Now, how do I – and I wasn't going to –
And he's about how old at that point, you know?
He was in his 20s, late 20s, in that order.
All right.
And I'm saying to myself, okay, let me get him to write with me. I found that he could write songs. I heard some of his stuff that he was writing. And he could play piano – I mean, drums – as well. So I said, okay, I'm going to get him to write some R&B songs with me. So he agreed to do that. And so that's how we got real close. We were writing around the clock. We were doing a tune called Stubborn Kind of Fella. And we're doing it for another act. And we would work on one song. We ran out of energy for that song. We'd start another one for somebody else. But in the meantime, we kept building it. So I would sing, in a Stubborn Kind of Fella, I would sing a line, you know, I try to put my arms around you, oh, because I do my line. Then he would want to come with real jazzy. And each time I reach for you, I said, no, Marvin, You got to get soulful, brother. You got to go back. Each time I reach for you, baby, you got to do like I'm doing.
Reach deep inside.
Reach deep inside. Yeah. So he started dealing with that. And we go on and on and on. And we'd be, and each day we'd work on these tunes. And I, when I saw he was getting tired, and I would get off and go into a whole other song. But we put it together. Now, when we finished the song, we had tape recorders in the rooms. Every we had like five rooms strictly for the producers, all my main guys. You know, Holland Dozier, Smokey, they hardly had their own room with the piano and the tape so they can work and keep, hang on to stuff. You know, stuff will get away from you if you don't make a recording of it. So we're working on this tune. When Marvin wasn't around, I took a razor blade. In those days, how you had to edit.
Well, yeah, and let's talk about what we're talking about. We're talking about recording tape.
Recording tape.
And it was magnetic tape, and it was probably about a quarter of an inch thick.
Exactly.
And you would splice that, because I did this in radio.
Okay.
You would splice it on a little splicing bar.
Right.
Then bring together the two parts you want, put some little white tape over it.
Right,
and
right.
Then when that went through the magnetic heads, it would play out the music. Hopefully it wouldn't break.
Yeah, right.
Right.
Get a little skip every now and then.
Yeah.
So I taped all of his parts together, took all of my parts out. So since it was verses, I could close them up. You got it? And so I told Marvin to come in. I said, come in, man. He came in this room. I said, I want you to listen to something. And I pressed the tape recorder. And he heard all of his verses tied together soulfully. You know what I mean? And he said, man, that sounds pretty good. I said, I know. I said, Marvin, do me a favor. Why don't you do this tune? He said, but we're writing it for the other act. I said, forget that. Why don't you do this tune? It'll take me off the hook with Barry, and then I can just start working on your jazz album. He said, William, why are you not trying to fool me, are you? I said, no, man. Listen, you see how you sound? I said, now, anything wrong with it, we'll fix while we're dubbing in. I'll sing the line. You know, you're going to take it from me. You're going to do it better than me, but at least you won't forget. He said, okay. We go in the studio. We dub it in. When we finished, it was hot. And then Barry was coming out. I was going to his office. He's coming down the walkway. And I said to him, give my money, man. He said, what money? I said, $1,000. He said, I ain't heard no music. So I had the demo in my hand. I said, here. He went upstairs to his office, came back down, reached in his pocket, gave him $1,000. And that was the beginning of Marvin Gaye's career in the R&B field.
You know, it's pretty remarkable when you tell stories like that to think of these people who have done so well, and yet they're somewhat humble beginnings. It's just really remarkable. And, you know, back then, while there were amateur hour shows like Ted Mack and things like that, really didn't have the American Idols, The Voice, and things like that that you've got now that sort of give people the opportunity to show what they can do. America's Got Talent, things like that just did not exist back in that day.
No.
And of course, you had so many other issues going on. The tragedy with Marvin Gaye was his demise.
Yes. Yes, that was very heavy.
Killed by his father.
Yeah, killed by his
story I covered back here in Los Angeles a long time ago.
Wow.
1980s. And I remember how shocking it was for everybody, including me.
Oh, man.
Because I liked listening to his music, and all of a sudden we get word that Marvin Gaye is shot. And we go to where the house is.
Did you go in the house?
Not in the house, but I was outside the house.
Mm-hmm.
And then we had the trial and all that, and it was quite the tragedy. I mean, a father takes the life of a son.
Did you go to the trial?
I don't remember.
You don't remember?
We
yet.
Have video of that
yeah,
here,
yeah, right.
But I can't remember if I actually was in the courtroom.
Courtroom, I got you.
Yeah, it's been three or four decades now.
I don't know how you got in, because it had to be a crowd of people out there.
Well,
be
because
ridiculous.
News media, when you go into cover, you tend to have credentials, and that gets you in the door. But we certainly all covered the story. If I wasn't in the courtroom, I was certainly doing stories that used that material. And I was at the house, and I did deal with the police and everything else that was going on that day. It was a huge tragedy. Your thoughts when you heard Dad pulled the trigger on the son?
I was in shock. I was in shock. It was just like, how all of a sudden you could do that? You know what I mean? It was like, people pull guns, they point them and talk a lot of trash before they do something. This was like up, bang. You know what I mean? I'm saying, wow, this was crazy. It was like unbelievable, I guess it's a better word. And Marvin, he loved his dad. He was always trying to prove something. and his success in the career and movements, he was doing things to show how much he loved and how much he was accomplishing and all that. You know, he never stopped doing that. You know, where other people would make money and they go buy some outrageous stuff and do all that, he would deal with the family, and that was his thing, to prove like a dad. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And which is great. So that was very, very devastating to me.
You still miss him?
Oh, very much. When, because of his music and the things that he was, I would not say trying to say, he actually said it, but he was trying to get others to relate to where he was coming from in the world and all the problems, and wanting to bring people together. And he used his music to make that happen. When he decided to do that What's Going On album, he was really serious about everything working in the same direction. I think he even had the feeling that it was spiritually inspired, that album.
Well, and you and I have talked about this. The song What's Going On was really kind of a mix of a protest song and a hope song. And,
yes.
You know, what's going on and why can't we all get along?
Yes.
Why can't we all get together? Yeah. Why can't we make it work? Was that something you wrote his music? Was that something that somebody wrote for him, or was
he wrote on his own? He wrote on his own.
He wrote that one.
Yeah, he worked on that album. I mean, around the clock.
Yeah.
And if I'm not mistaken, he even said that he was inspired to do that. You know, spiritually inspired to make that happen, which is phenomenal because I know that feeling. Once you get spiritually inspired to do something, nothing stops you. You can go night and day. And you may think you've finished a moment or a phrase or something, and you won't stop until you spiritually you feel it's correct. In other words, you can keep redoing it until it comes out right, that you can let it go. And that could take a while. And some tunes will come to you in a minute, right straight through the whole song. I've been in that position, so I know how he felt doing that.
Now let's listen to a little of Marvin Gaye.
Every time.
If you were to sort of sum up your career, I know you're still a very active guy and you have this play, but if you were to sum up what you've accomplished in the, I won't say how many decades that you've been working, how would you frame that?
I would say that, I'm very happy. I'm very happy because I recognize the gift that was given me, like we all have gifts. And when I recognized it was a gift, then I could go about it very conscientiously and really reach for results. And I'm very happy about that. And it keeps me feeling that time and days and ages and dates are just words. It's what's in your heart. If you're working from in your heart towards something, there is no time, no age, no dates.
And, you know, when we think about Motown, we think about the Supremes. We think about all these incredible performers. I don't know how much you had to do with Diana Ross and the Supremes. Mm-hmm. Did you have much to do with them?
Not a lot, other than making sure they were in the studio on time and doing their job. And my main job with Diana Ross and the Supremes was working with Holland Dozier Holland, who were the producers, who were some of the greatest producers in the world. And working with them, and they did most of the Supreme songs. That was a joy.
One of my favorite albums was it's Supremes, and it was TLC with what was the group she was with? It was the Supremes and another not the Four Tops.
Temptations. Yeah,
yeah. And what an album that was! I mean, you know, as a kid growing up, and I grew up in this heyday. I used to love all of this music.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, whether it was Temptations, Supremes, Four Tops, Smokey Robinson, The Miracles, whatever. It was just the best stuff. And, you know, we go from generation to generation. And, you know, I guess I'd like to ask you, where are we now in music?
I think, for me, every 7 years the thing flips around, all right? And I think it's but Motown, the music of Motown is forever. And I say that because after 60 years, it's still going strong. And I told Barry at the Grammy, the 60th award thing for Motown, I said, listen, man, we were on the stage, he and I and Smokey. And he was saying, man, this is incredible. And who would have thought it could go like this? And I was tapping him on the shoulder while he was talking. He said, what are you doing? I said, it all came from the man upstairs. This was predestined to go this way. Whatever God does lasts forever. Smokey say, I keep trying to tell you, man. I keep trying to tell you.
Well, yeah, Smokey Robinson, what a great guy. I just want to ask you about the future. And what do you think lies ahead for these various music genres that we see? Every generation brings new genres, new stars, new singers, new performers. Somehow the soulful sounds always kind of hang in there. Whether we end up with hip-hop or this or that or the other, we still tend to have those sort of soulful sounds from the 60s,
hanging in,
70s.
It keeps coming through.
Yeah, it does.
Yeah. Because they were, for me, they were based on a time when everybody needed something to hang on to. So the music had more substance to it. The lyrics had more meaning to them. Not that the lyrics and things are not that today, but we're living in a time where meaning does not stand for what it's not there anymore.
It's not always about the message.
Not always about the message.
Right.
It's about the moment.
Right.
And we're living in moments, you know what I mean? And I think we need to do something about it. I believe that. I think and since we're living and everything is at the moment and doesn't last long, it's constantly coming. Now they got to keep creating, where instead of planting, they're creating.
Yeah, but isn't that part of that driven by social media, by streaming, by all the different things we do now that we never used to do before?
Well, because now we don't have the time to take time for, to devote time at something that means something. We our minds keep moving around. New things are coming, and everybody wants to be involved with the new. Where is the time where you really socialize with your brother or your friend? Where is that gone?
Yeah, I know. That's a fair question. And the other thing is, when I was a kid, and that was a while ago. When I was a kid, I remember I'd go to the record store. I'd get the top 10, the Billboard this, the whatever, and I knew what was coming out, just like a movie coming out. And I knew when a star like a Diana Ross or a Marvin Gaye or whatever was coming out with a new album, and I'd go to the store to go get it. I remember, I'll tell you a funny story, one of the first album stories that I have. My mom took me to Kaufman's department store in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and I wanted to get some Beatle music. And I had a choice. I could get one thing or the other thing, but I couldn't get both. Mom said you could get the single of She Loves You, or you can get the album that has I Want to Hold Your Hand, which didn't have She Loves You, as I recall. And here I was with this sort of choice of what do I do. So I got the 45, never realizing that the album was going to become
huge,
titanium,
huge,
platinum, whatever.
Huge.
And had every song became a hit. And but you know it's funny back then albums and 45s and even a little bit before that with 33 and a thirds, you know, it was a you do remember that, don't
yeah,
you?
Oh yeah.
It was well, let me take you back to 78s. How about that one?
Oh boy.
But it was, you know, it was a different time. And now we don't have the record stores. We don't have that. We stream. We pull things from the iTunes store, or the Spotify, or the this or the that. And it's an entirely different world.
And when you pull from those places, you don't really get into the character of the artist. You just take the single song that you want to hear.
Well, you don't have the cover notes.
You don't have the cover
You don't
notes.
Have the pictures
right.
on the
You're
covers.
Right.
You don't have all that. And that was part of the fun.
Yes.
You know, I remember some albums that some of you guys in Hollywood and wherever we would come up with, and they'd be like double albums.
Yes.
So you'd open up a thing like a book. There'd be a record on each side, and then all these pictures and stories, and like that was half the fun.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
That was half the fun, was to read the record, read the covers.
Yes, yes.
So,
to,
I mean,
get
you know,
to know the talent yeah. before you hear them.
And there are a lot of people today that weren't around when that happened, and they don't really know that. I mean, you know, the LPs are starting to make a resurgence because people kind of think vinyl is cool again. But, you know, it was a different time. It was a different place, and it was a different – I want to say it was kind of a different planet at that time.
I love that it's coming back around. Like,
yeah.
Because when I left Motown, I started on my own line, and I did – I had the Funk Brothers come in and record, and I did all this product, you know, like 300-400 songs and stuff like that, different artists. And my son would say to me, "Dad, what you going to do with that?" I say, "Well, one day it'll be valuable." And now it's coming back. I mean, they're coming because we recorded on warm machines then. I mean, you know, 24-track and 8-track, and so the music had a warmer feeling to it,
right?
Not so electronically produced, you know what I mean? And now it's coming back. And like you say, on the vinyl.
So where are the 8-tracks?
I got 8. I got
8-tracks, cassettes.
I got 16s and 24-track recordings. That
yeah, but I'm talking about those 8-track tapes that go into your car.
And you go, "Yeah, I got to be here, I got to go be here."
Yeah, right. Yeah, and I remember how if a tape went bad, all of a sudden the big loop would come out.
Right,
and
right.
You'd be, "Oh, my God, what do I do now?" You know?
Right.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun back then. But what the hell?
Yeah, right.
Right? What the hell?
What the hell?
What the hell? Well, I'd like to a couple of final thoughts. Any final thought that you'd like to sort of offer up about career, life, stars, Marvin, whatever.
Well, I do a lot of speaking things, and my point is to the younger people when I'm talking with them that they can do anything today, which is really great, but they got to really devote the time to it. Without that. There's so many distractions, you know, for them, and it takes away the time. By the time they really to get into what they want to create, they've eaten up their hours. They sleep 8, they go to school 8, and then they play games and stuff.
Yeah, Grandpa always said you sleep away a third of your life.
A third of your life.
Right.
So they got to break some of that down and make it pay off towards the goals. And other than that, to accomplish something, it's going to be much tougher. So I make it a point to say, you know, with Motown and the Marvins and the Stevies, we spent that time. And no matter who you are and whenever time you're in, you got to spend time on something that you believe in to develop, to make it happen.
Yeah, nothing happens overnight and nothing happens in a vacuum.
No.
It really does take a village for a lot of different kinds of things.
Yes, and the village is great because you got to surround yourself or try to find the people that's encouraging, not the ones that want to pull you back or hold you back. You got to find that, so that'll make you develop and move forward. And I try to make that clear. I think these are the gifts given me and others once we have accomplished things to let you know how it was done, so that you can do it too, even greater.
Well, you've accomplished a hell of a lot, and you notice I said a hell of a lot. And again, the book is Motown's First A&R Man Presents the A&R Man by William Mickey Stevenson. And I'm gonna wrap it up here, but I'd like to go out on a Marvin Gaye song.
All right,
like a Stubborn Fella, like
Stubborn
that one.
Kind
okay,
of fella.
Stubborn Kind of Fella. So let me just say this. Let me just say that, you know, if you don't subscribe yet to my podcast, What the Hell, please do. Of course, we're building an audience out there. We'd love to have you joining us for all these various episodes. Thanks for joining us this week. We'll see you next time. And Mickey, hit it.
I try to put my arms around you all because I wanna hold you tight. And every time I reach for you, baby, try to kiss you, you just jump clean out of sight. Now I've got news for you, baby, I made plans for two. I'm just a stubborn kind of fella, got my mind made up to love you. How's that?
Love it. See you next time, everybody.